What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Caddy Network's Under the Strap podcast. I'm your host, TJ Auclair, Director of Content for the Caddy Network. Be sure to give us a follow on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Caddy Network. This week, we're excited to welcome PGA Tour caddies John Cub Burke and Tony Navarro, two men with 80-plus years of experience between them. Burke, a caddy since the early 1980s and a veteran of four Ryder Cups where he looped for the likes of Brad Faxon and Davis Love III, is currently part of a bag share, more on that in a bit, with Bill Haas. Navarro, meanwhile, started caddying in 1978 and has caddied for Hall of Famers Raymond Floyd and Greg Norman, as well as Adam Scott, and is presently with Nick Watney. Let's get started. Tony, thanks for joining us. Beginning with you, can you just tell the listeners how you got your start as a caddy back in the late 1970s and what it was that drew you to the PGA Tour and how you got out there?
Sure. Thanks for having me, by the way. I caddied at the John Deere, well, what was then the Hardee's Classic, which is now the John Deere Classic, when I was young, 16, 17 years old. And didn't really have any idea what I wanted to do after school. I figured that I had a friend that wanted to travel a little bit, so we decided that we'd take off for a summer and go caddy, follow the tour, because back then there weren't that many caddies that followed the tour. I'd say approximately 50 guys, maybe, that caddied full-time on tour. So we jumped in a bus the day after we graduated from high school and went to Glen Abbey Golf Club in Ontario and stood in the parking lot and waited to try to get a bag for the week.
Wow. And did you ever think you'd be out there as long as you've been?
No. I thought if I made it 3 months, I'd have been pretty fortunate. So, no, it's been good to me. So it was a good move, and it was pretty much purely unintentional.
Okay. And Cub, how about you? How'd you get your start?
Well, you know, I remember a bunch of us went down to Vegas to watch that tournament back in 81, I think it was. A bunch of the guys I hung out with at home, a bunch of my hockey teammates and stuff, to go down there and party, and we were watching the golf. And I kind of was watching that caddy and player relationship. Thought that was pretty cool. And Tommy Sanderson, who used to play the tour, was Mark Wiebe's teacher at the time. So he kind of set me up with Mark Wiebe in 1981 to talk to him about it at the Keno room at the Desert Inn. So I talked to Mark about caddy, and he wasn't about to hire me. And I wasn't, you know, I was running the ski shop and everything. But in 1985, Charlie Bowling Jr. came in. I think it was 86. Taking a break from a week on the West Coast, taking a break from San Diego. And when he was leaving, after we hung out for the week, when he was leaving to go back on a tour, I said, hey, if you ever need a caddy, call me. Thinking it's never going to happen. And then he fired crack Eddie Terrell a month later. You remember crack Eddie Terrell, right, Tony?
Yeah, I remember Eddie.
he called me up and asked me to, yeah, let's go out and give it a try. And then I caddied for him for 3 weeks. He missed every cut. He asked me to finish the summer. You know, and I said, oh, this is great. I get my weekends off. You know, so that's how I got out there. Charlie was really good. You know, he introduced me to everybody. And, you know, he always introduced me as Cub or Cubby, never John Burke. You know, so I was lucky. He was so good to me.
Now, speaking of Cub and Cubby, that's one of the great nicknames. Tell us how you got that nickname.
Well, I was playing hockey in 76, I think, with some of my hockey teammates at the time. And I'm a chop. I'm not a great golfer by any means. You know? And I remember I was pretty hungover. In that first nine holes, I shot 33. And it was when Jack's heyday, the Golden Bear, you know, and I had the kind of the blonde hair. And I was hefty like Jack, they started calling me the Golden Cup. And then on the back nine, I proceeded to shoot 48. So I had that 33-48, and as if we were walking off 18 green, they all kind of unanimously decided to take the golden away. So they just started calling me Cup. So I was a Golden Cup for about about 8 holes. So that's how it happened. That's that drop the mic right there.
Yeah. Now, Cub, you mentioned a few minutes ago, too, the skiing. Tell us a little bit about your background with skiing. I know you're out in Sun Valley, Idaho. I also want to know what that commute is like for you when you've got to get to events. I can't imagine it's the easiest thing in the world getting in and out of there. So just tell us about skiing and living out in Sun Valley.
Well, you know, I moved here in like 75 to play hockey here because nobody else wanted me anywhere else. I got paid to leave playing in Reno. And it was, I had some friends here, and they said, you got to come here. You know, they just started a pretty good hockey team, and I started playing here. And I was always a skier, too. So, you know, I loved coming here. And when I drove into this valley, I fell in love with it right away. You know, there's very few places in the country as pretty as this. And you can go so many different directions, and it's just so beautiful and stuff. And it's good, clean mountain air. So, you know, skiing, playing hockey, you know, that's the life I was living, you know, and managing, and I was managing a ski shop, and that's how I made the connection to go out on tour. So actually the first 6 or 7 years I was caddying for Brad, I would stay home till after the hockey season and the ski season, and then I would go out and start working either in Masters or Hilton Head, you know, all the way through the rest of the year. Yeah, I did that for
uh-huh. If I might add to that, he is a phenomenal ski instructor. He taught my wife to ski when we went out to Sun Valley to visit him. She could ski okay, and she made it down the first couple of hills. Cubby was very impressed, so he thought he might take her over to the Black Trails. And she didn't normally use poles, so he's going to teach her how to set that pole and push off it. Well, she made it about 40 yards before she planted it in her chin down the bottom of the hill. Ruined her 3-day ski vacation right there. But, yeah.
I literally knocked out Tony's wife.
Oh, man.
And we had to follow her down the mountain to follow the toboggan. And not, I knew the ski patrol guys, too, and they went, not another one, Cup.
Tony, tell us about your friendship with Cubby. Goes back almost 40 years now, I guess, close to it. But
close to 40, yeah.
Yeah, tell us about that friendship.
Well, we've been through a lot together. We've seen each other through some very fun times, and we've seen each other suffer, and it hasn't been fun to watch that. But Cubby's been a dear friend of mine. He always takes a pee out of me. He always wants, you know, he always wants to have the first jab in on you. So I like a guy like that. But no, Cubby and I have traveled the world really together. I've been on Ryder Cup teams and sorts, and been against each other in President's Cup teams, and we just had a lot of fun, and we have many, many things to laugh about without even saying a word. We just look at each other and something hits us and just starts cracking up, as you know he does with most everybody. But when I see him, it always brings a smile to my face.
That's great. And Cub, how about you? What do you make of that relationship? Was Tony one of those guys early on that you kind of gravitated towards?
Well, you know, when I first got on his tour, you were still supposed to keep your mouth shut for about a year. And that was really hard for me. So, and I was actually going, you know, if I'm going to do this, I better get good at it. And there was about 5 guys I listened to when they caddied, and Tony was one of them. And Johnny Buckner was another one who caddied for Joey Sindelar. You know, guys that I really respect. Bruce Edwards was another one. And, you know, after a year or two, you know, guys started to be more friendly to you because you're accepted more. You had to kind of pay your dues, and Tony was always really good to me. He always was. And like you said, we've been through a lot together. We've stayed together a few times with our players and without them, and we've had a lot of fun. And, you know, and it's just when you've been out there a long time and you see how it's changed so much, there's a bond there that you've survived so much out there. you know, together. And there's not a whole lot of us. There certainly is not a lot of caddies left from the 70s. And there's not a lot from the 80s either. So there's a, excuse me, there's a friendship there for sure that I really treasure. And, you know, I'll take it all the way to the end, you know, whenever that could be. Could be after Colonial.
Did you feel that way about me after we played the 11th hole at Muirfield that day when you were caddying for Davis? Did you still like me then?
Hey, every time we caddied together, I always thought one of us could lose our job that day. Because we had too much fun out there for sure. Now, you'll have to refresh my memory what happened on the 11th hole at Muirfield.
Well, you decided to talk Davis into hitting that driver. And the first one got away a little bit right. Oh. Yeah.
No, that, I thought you were talking about British Open Muirfield. I would remember that. And that was my last day with Davis. It was my birthday.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And actually, he asked me what I liked, and I said 3-wood, 5-wood. And he pulled out driver, and he hit it out of bounds right.
But you got the blame for it.
Yeah. No, then he took the 3-wood, hit it up there, and then he hit 5-wood. And as he was walking away, he hit 3-wood, 5-wood, and he proceeded, I think, to shoot like 42 that night. And sure enough, I caddied with you and lost the best job I ever had. Took him 8 years. Yeah, I remember that vividly. He didn't show up for my dinner party with Frank and Stuart that night. Dinner.
Guys, Cubby, you just mentioned, and Tony too, about how much things have changed over the years out on tour as a caddy. Can you tell us what some of those things are? I mean, clearly the stakes are much bigger now than when you first started. But what kinds of things about your job have changed over the years? Tony, start with you.
Well, I think that the friendships have changed a lot. We used to hang in big groups and all bond together a lot more than we do now. We separate ourselves from each other, and I don't know that that's a good or a bad thing. We used to have a lot of fun. We used to show up, honestly, 3 hours before our round just to sit around with the other caddies and listen to all the what was mostly BS, you know, but it was fun. It was worth the price of admission. You had nothing else going on, so let's go to the golf course, hear some lies, you know, and it was fun. And we just we could poke fun at each other, and nobody took offense, and we would all ride together. I mean, you wouldn't leave the hotel without a car full of people. You wouldn't leave anybody behind. You wouldn't leave the golf course until the car was full. To get everybody back to the hotel. So it was a lot closer knit group back then. Of course, you didn't just show up to the golf course on Tuesday and pick up a yardage book and a greens book and go out and play your practice round. You had to do a lot more homework. We didn't have lasers. We used wheels, or we just stepped our yardages off, or used ropes over water. All different types of things to make up our own yardage books. We had a general yardage book, but it wasn't very complicated. It was pretty much just a map of where you want to play. So those are a couple of the things that I've noticed a lot, you know, that have changed. And again, I'm not sure it's for the better, but it's just the way it is now. And hey, it's a good tour we're working on.
Mm-hmm. And Cubby, how about the treatment of caddies since the time you started to now? Has the hospitality gotten better?
Oh yeah, it's got a lot better thanks to a lot of pioneers before, you know, the current situation. But I mean, we were wearing jeans and T-shirts, you know, and you know, like there's a couple of guys that might have pressed their jeans and had a crease in them. But, you know, that was about it, you know. And there wasn't, you know, there's a hangout area and that was it. There was no place else we could go. But that hangout area, like Tony said, was so much fun. I mean, there would be like Herman and caddy for Lee. He'd be holding court, or someone else would be holding court. And it was, there's just a lot of characters out there. And, you know, actually it didn't happen until the early 90s when they tried to get to do the shuttling stuff that we said with, you know, we use that kind of as a tool to try and improve our treatment. And ever since then, and they've made major strides. The treatment of the caddies is just, it's night and day the way it used to be. I mean, we were told where to go to the bathroom, and that was blue water. And, you know, there was a definite line between player and caddies. You know, that line's kind of blurred now, you know. So, and you got to hand it to the tour, you know, and a lot of work previous caddies have made to help that, to change the treatment and the outcome. We get catered food every week. There's, you know, showers available, you know, so you don't have to get on an airplane, you know. Like Tony said before, it was four or five guys in a car, you know, four or five guys in a room.
We didn't even have access to food other than concession tents back in the old days. They wouldn't even allow you to go into the pro shop to get a pencil and a scorecard to, you know, write some yardages down. I mean, it was off limits to caddies. And I mean, as Cubby says, they have really come a long way. And the caddies have also, you know, provided that for themselves. You know, they've brought up their standards and I think they've gained a lot more respect than maybe we did in the beginning.
Okay. Now, Tony, we're going to get to this a little bit more in a few minutes about, you know, your long relationship with Greg Norman, caddying for him. I read somewhere, though, that in 1999, you were actually approached about taking Tiger's bag, but chose not to because of the loyalty that you had for Greg. Can you tell us about how that unfolded? And, you know, Tiger obviously has had a tremendous career. You enjoyed a great career with Greg there. But was the decision difficult at all or pretty easy one for you?
There really, in my mind, there wasn't a decision. Greg looked after me so well for so many years. He did so many nice things for myself, my wife, my family. I mean, yes, Tiger Woods is the greatest golfer, maybe the greatest golfer ever lived. I've known Tiger since he was 16 years old, enjoyed his company, enjoyed being around him, watching him grow his golf game. You know, that's been a great thing. But the things that Greg gave me are irreplaceable. And for that reason, and that reason alone, there was no reason, there was no way I was going to take any job.
Yeah.
But, I was just in a fortunate position. Butch Harmon, who was Greg's instructor at the same time, knew that Greg was slowing his pace down, slowing his tournament play down and kind of starting to fade away. And Butch was actually just trying to look after me and also try to put Tiger with somebody who knew the ropes. And that's pretty much how it came about. And Butch contacted me and said, "Hey, would you like to take the job?" And I said, "Thanks a lot, but pretty happy where I am." So, and that's just the way it went. Nothing much bigger than that. That's just the story in a nutshell there.
Cool. And Cubby, a couple minutes ago, you were talking about getting canned on your birthday. I just want to talk to you guys and seasoned veterans. In your gig, though, so you get fired at some point, right? I mean, that's just, it comes with the territory. So how long does it take you to get over that and move on? And has it gotten easier for you guys over the years? I mean, you guys have been pretty consistent with the players you've been with, but is it any easier since you've been out there so long?
You know, Tony brought up some, you know, good points. I mean, loyalty, you know, back there was kind of the caddies were very loyal to their players, not so much the other way. So when you get fired, really, you don't get over it until you get another job, you know. And it's never a good feeling, you know. It depends. I mean, sometimes it's kind of a relief and everything. I mean, subconsciously, I think I tried to get fired a few times. You know,
you did well. You really did well.
And I succeeded doing that. You know, but or else, you know, maybe it's a wise ass remark, and here or there led eventually to that. But you know, it takes some time. It hurts, and anybody says it doesn't hurt, they're lying. You know, because you take pride in your job. You know, you really do. You don't want to be that guy. And then you're watching how he's playing afterwards, you know, and you're kind of, you're pulling for him, and then you're pulling for your guy too. So it hurts. It takes really till you get another job.
Yeah. And Tony, a couple of guys that you've caddied for, we just mentioned Norman. There was also Raymond Floyd, two Hall of Famers there. Both ultra, super, super competitive guys. I read where Raymond Floyd said Tony was like a son to me. You just talked a little bit about your relationship with Greg. Can you tell us what those relationships were like inside the ropes on the course? Because to be with guys that competitive, I can't imagine that you're just standing around as a yes man. You're probably very much involved in the decisions that are being made. So tell us what that dynamic was like for you with those two players.
Oh, it's very exciting. I mean, it's an exciting time when you're working for guys that are on the leaderboard week in, week out. You expect to be there. I couldn't say that you'd expect to win, but you expect to be on the leaderboard and have a chance to win every week. I guess it's an uncomfortable position at first, but you get very used to it and very comfortable with it once you get there. But to be honest with you, TJ, I had a lot of guys before that, maybe not Hall of Famers, but very good players, you know. So it wasn't like I just went from falling out of Moline High School into working for, you know,
sure,
major champions. You know, I worked for a lot of good players, Dave Eichelberger's, Dan Pohl, Keith Fergus type, Jeff Sluman type players, you know, that seasoned me for, you know, what I was about to, you know, take on next. So I was comfortable with it. I really was. And I enjoyed it. Hopefully I did a good job at it. You know, you can always do better, but hopefully I was good enough at it.
And I believe, was it like your third week out with Greg that you guys won the British Open? Is that right?
I don't believe it was the third week out. It might have been the third major that we
did. Third major, I'm sorry. Okay. Can you talk about that week? I mean, that had to be pretty exciting, just three majors in to knock one off.
It was a very exciting week. Actually, it started out a little rocky. He hit a perfect drive down the first hole. And as we're walking down to the fairway, the marshal can't find the ball. It was dead down the center of the fairway. But it's got humps all over it, so it could kick it anywhere into the high grass. And we lost the ball. We started out the tournament with a six. So I'm thinking it could have been a very short week. I wasn't looking for anything special heading back to that first tee to hit another ball. But as the week went on, he played brilliantly. It was a perfect golf course for him because he was a great driver of the ball. He liked to chase the ball down the fairway, which was a shot that you need on that golf course, Royal St. George's. It's not one that you want to hit a lot of height. Lofted drives down the fairway. So it was a perfect golf course for him. He always played the British Open well. He always took a little different approach when he was playing in the wind. He didn't spin the ball as much. He was a lot, I don't know, he was just a different person when he'd get to that type of a golf course. And it was fun, and I remember it. Just walking down that last hole, watching him wave his hat around, and you know, the people, the last hole at any British Open is one of the greatest atmospheres in sports. It's U-shaped lined for about 175 yards all the way down to the green, with people probably 60 aisles high in the stands, and it's a great feeling. And they give a great ovation to most everybody that finishes on Sunday, let alone the winner. So it was a really great day for me and for Greg, and something I'll always cherish.
Yeah. And Cubby Antoni, Tony mentioned a name, a player name a couple minutes ago that seems to come up in every one of these podcasts with the caddies that have been around a while, and that's Jeff Sluman. I'm just wondering if you could share a fun story about Slu, because whenever I talk to these caddies, whether it's a funny nickname, a great story, or a great prank, it seems like it originated from Sluman. So what is it about Slu, Cubby?
Well, you know, Slu, it just makes me laugh when I think about Slu, you know, because I used to stay with him a bunch of times, and I'd stay with him with Tony, too. But I remember it was Greensboro once, and I was sitting, hanging out with the caddies, and Slu was walking by, and it was the early 90s. And I don't know if you were working for him or not, Tony. I'm not quite sure, but I said, Slu, where are you going? He says, I'm going to the range to practice mediocrity. That was Slu for you right there. You know, but you know what? Slu was a hell of a player, and he was a character, and he was fun to be around, but he could play. We're talking Ryder Cups and winning golf tournaments and everything. He was a steady Eddie player.
PGA champion.
PGA champion, yep. Yep. Yeah. And, he was just a funny guy, and he liked to have fun, too. He liked to have fun.
And, Tony, what was that like for you? Fun guy to caddy for?
Great guy. Wonderful friend. Actually, he's the one that pushed me out the door to get to Greg's job. I was offered Greg's job, and I really enjoyed working for Sluman at the time. And Jeff told me, he says, well, Tony, I've got you this van, and Greg's got a G4. he said, let me take this one out for you here, Tony. Let me help
Good choice, Tony. I stuck with the van.
Pretty much he just said, Tony, you're a fool not to take this job if you don't. I mean, you want to have a family someday. You know, you and Sarah deserve to take a chance on this. So that's what happened. But he's a great guy, and he had a lot of caddy in him. He never passed a caddy area without, as Cubby says, without throwing a few.
And you know what? That's the highest compliment you can actually pay a player. You have a lot of caddy in you. That's seriously, that's the highest compliment you can.
To us, it is. You're right. I think so. He's one of us. He's one of the guys.
Yeah, he likes to hang around and have a good time, for sure. Caddy locker room is like a caddy room is closest thing I've ever seen to a hockey locker room. You know, it's a fun place to be. If you can survive the caddy room, you can survive anywhere.
That's great. Tony, being with Greg at his peak, you kind of joked there about the G4, but for you, Greg treated you like family, so you were traveling that way, right? You were taking rides.
Well, you know, on occasion. I wasn't week to week.
Okay, it wasn't week to week. But still, I mean, were there ever times where you had to, like, pinch yourself because of the experiences that you were having, you know, at that level?
Yeah, yes, and I still do. I mean, he and his wife, Laura, treated my wife and I and our children as his own family. I mean, I bet I've spent – over a year's worth of weeks down at his house, just going down, practicing with him, you know, just on off weeks, we'd go do things, bring the family if you'd like, bring your wife. He'd take my wife and I to Switzerland with him, to Ireland, all different places around the world. I mean, who gets a chance to do that? And who gets a chance to bring their family or their wife along with and be treated so well? But that's how Greg is. And his wife, Laura, she was just fabulous. Always treated my wife and my family so, so well, as I say, as they were her own. So, yes, I do pinch myself as to all those things. But you also need to not rub that in everybody's face. So, you know, you also have to be on the down low with a lot of that stuff, because it's pretty hard to tell people that without sounding a little braggadocious, you know, and I don't like that. So I pretty much tend to keep that to myself.
Yeah. And Tony, if I could ask you too about the 96 Masters, the success that you and Greg had together, undeniable, but that, I'm sure that was a very tough week for you too as the caddy. Can you tell us what the aftermath was like for you? Because along with being the caddy, he was a great friend of yours. So that had to be pretty difficult.
What year was that again? I'm sorry. What year? I might have to look that one up.
You might want to talk about another one of the majors they won.
Yeah. Can I turn around for this one? Or?
Tony took that back. He wasn't there Sunday. I actually caddied the back nine. I'll cover if I did. I just didn't have a good back nine.
No, absolutely. It had all the makings of a great week. Course record 63. Really felt on top of his game. We went out actually on Wednesday afternoon. I'll never forget. We were the last ones to tee off because they closed the tee at 2 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon because of the par three contest. They want everybody playing the par three. So we went out and played a late nine on Wednesday afternoon, and something just clicked. He and Butch were working on some things, and something just clicked, and he felt really good about his game. I felt great about his game. Butch was confident as could be, and things were going along real smooth there till we hit the other side of the clubhouse on Sunday afternoon, as it was about 2:40 tee time or something like that. Warmed up great, looked fine to me. Butch sensed that there was something maybe not right, but I was ready to go on out there and enjoy the day and hopefully have a good time at the end of the day. But it started out tough. First tee shot was in the ninth fairway, left of the trees. Greg never hit it left. He'd hit it anywhere but left. And that was kind of the first signal that something wasn't quite right. Ended up making bogey, played fine, just didn't make any putts, didn't get anything up and down. I made a very bad call for him on the eighth hole. We had approximately 250 yards to the hole. The pin was right on the front of the green, really easy hole location. And it was a good number for a three wood to get right on there on the green. But the bad thing is, if you miss a three wood at all, it's a really tough up and down. If you're right of that pin, very tough. Left of the pin, pine needles, woods. Well, we hit it left of the flag. And he made a par, which was nice. But if I'd just give him a three iron or two iron, played him up 30 yards short of the green, it was such an easy up and down. Might have changed the complexion. I don't know if it would have, but might have changed the complexion of the day. Went on, bogeyed ninth hole, 10th hole, 11th, water on 12. Rest of the story is the rest of the story. Just things just kind of fell apart and really didn't hit that many bad shots. Hit a bad shot on 12, hit it right of the flag there, where everybody hit it last year against Tiger, place you cannot – he can never be. He knew that. Everybody knows that you hit it right over the center of the bunker, you know, with the right pin there. But he actually had hitting it fairly close, maybe seems like it was 15 or 20 feet on 11, and three putt from it. Missed the green on 10, just left of the flag with the left pin placement. Very simply up and down for him normally. He didn't get it up and down. So it was just – he couldn't get the handle on it, and it got away from him. He took it like a man. He never put any blame on me or put any blame on anybody. Congratulated Nick. I tell you, to this day, it's one of the times I really, as much as I hated to have that happen, I really respected him for the way he handled himself. I mean, really a champion, way he handled that. So
well, thanks for sharing that, Tony.
Yeah, thanks for asking.
Anything else you want to bring up?
Any dental work you want to talk about?
Really, you want to talk about all those penalties I caused all my players? go ahead, TJ. I've known you since you were in diapers.
So I want to talk to you guys about Ryder Cup and President's Cup. I know, you know, two events that players and caddies look forward to every year. Tell me about some of your most fun experiences from those two. Cubby, let's start with you.
I don't think I had any. I was 0-4 in the Ryder Cup. The European players loved seeing me when I showed up there. After losing four of them, I tried to get Sergio to hire me so the Americans would win one. And he wouldn't do it. In all seriousness, if I can do it, it was an honor. There's no other event like it in golf. It's intense. There's camaraderie just being in that room together. The way it's set up, the competition and everything. You can't even really describe it unless you do it. And once you get there, you know, you're definitely – I remember being so nervous the first tee there. My first major, I remember being really nervous in my first Ryder Cup. I remember being really nervous. And the memories are awesome. You know, all of them are great. You know, obviously we lost a couple of more heartbreakers and, you know, three of them were. One of them we kind of got thumped. And, you know, I just loved it. And the President's Cup too, I really enjoyed that. You know, those are days I'll cherish forever. It's an honor.
And Tony?
Yeah, I agree with Cubby. Everything he said there. I was fortunate enough to caddy in a few Ryder Cups myself for some really great match players. And got to see some great golf. Lanny Watkins, Raymond Floyd, Ben Crenshaw, Ben Curtis 1 year. So got to see some really, really outstanding golf guys that were really tough in the clinches, but also like Cubby, I was on more losing teams than I was winning. So, but and I was on I was I caddied in a lot of President's Cups as well, and they're fun. They're a lot of work. Cubby doesn't say that, you know. They're so much work. I mean, it's 6 days of going at it morning, noon, night, and these guys have so many commitments to do that it takes a lot out of them. But as Cubby says, it's an honor, and if you're there, you're working for a really outstanding player. So just to be with those guys is something you cherish. Mm-hmm.
Guys, during this quarantine, ESPN ran the Last Dance documentary with Michael Jordan. I don't know if you guys had a chance to watch it yet. It's excellent. But, Cubby, I know that you have a funny story about MJ. I believe it was at Valderrama 97 Ryder Cup.
It was. In fact, I just finished episode 8 last night, you know. And I just sent a text to Keegan and John Curran because they're friends of MJ's. And, you know, I got to be around him a little bit there. And I told him to tell MJ to take a seat. I've won 12 championships in the last 8 years in hockey. Tell it, what is this last dance crap? Take a seat, MJ. But I remember the first time I ever saw it was the 97 Ryder Cup at Valderrama, and we were teeing off first. It was Brad and Freddie, and it was against Bernie. And I'm trying to think. I think it was Bernie, and I can't remember the fourth. Maybe Colin. And we're on the first tee, and there was really – and it's early in the morning. It's kind of cold and kind of foggy and everything. It's like 7:10 or something. And there's a partition, like hockey boards, in between, you know, separating us from the fans. But there's really no fans there. And I'm kind of doing stuff and getting balls ready and talking to Brad at the same time. And I feel somebody on my right, and I turn over, and he's no farther than 3-4 feet away, and it's MJ, right? And he's looking at me, and he gives me this masculine, I'm talking masculine fist bump. He just gives it, right? He's looking right in my face, and he goes like that, you know? And I'm kind of caught off guard, right? So I look at him, and I got this big, stupid, goofy smile on my face, and I go, like that, you know? And he looked at me and went, what is wrong with this guy, you know? And I turned the other way. And that was it. That was my first encounter with the guy. You know, and I felt that way walking away. I said, boy, that was weak. That was weak.
And did you not do something later on to kind of...
Well, that even added words to it because he was on the back of Tom Kite's cart and they had the beverages for the players going around. It wasn't at every hole, right? So you had to make sure your player had water all the time in those, you know, in those events, like you do most of the time, but they really needed there to wet their whistle. And I ran up to get some water, and he's standing, and he's kind of over the cooler. His legs are so long, right? And he's at the back of the cart, and his legs are in the way for me to get the cooler. So I thought I'd be more manly and hit him on the leg and tell him to get the out of the way, you know, so I could get. So I did that. Yeah. You know, I was going to show him how manly I was. And I grabbed the water. What the look he gave me the second time was worse than the look he gave me the first time. So I'd already dug a hole in him. I asked him years later when I was with Keegan and John, do you remember that? And he goes, yeah, I do remember that. He goes, how could I forget that? Is what he said.
The world is Cubby's dartboard.
Yeah. I don't know. You can throw darts as good as any of them, Tony.
So, Tony, over all these years, can you share maybe the one highlight for you that stands above them all?
Oh. I guess, the British Open was pretty darn strong, but maybe the TPC that Greg won in 96, I think it was. He shot about 24 under par, won by 4 or 5 shots, and second place was 4 or 5 shots in front of the next guy. Greg only made one bogey the whole week. He three-putt the 13th hole. The pin was on the bottom level on the left side. We'd hit the ball on the top right, so it was – the closest you could get the putt was about 8 feet. So he hit it about 8 feet, missed the putt. That was his only bogey of the week. I mean, it was just unbelievable golf. Again, there he was on his game. When he was on his game, it was quite a show. And everybody loved to watch it. The players or the caddies in the group, they knew it was something special when he was on.
Mm-hmm. And Cubby, how about you? I want to throw this out here before I ask you about your highlight, but I saw a video the other day, and I remember being there as a 12-year-old kid, faxing at Pleasant Valley, New England Classic, and, man, you had a pretty sweet haircut going for that tournament. But what would be one of your highlights? I'm sure that had to be up there because for a guy like Faxon, his home game, that's almost like a major. So where does that rank you, and what's your number one highlight?
I had a pretty good salad going right there, didn't
you? Sure did.
You know, obviously, when you're, you know, Faxon's first win at the Buick when he beat Chip Peck in a playoff, that was definitely a highlight, you know. And that Pleasant Valley, that was a home tournament. That was a big deal for Fax, that putt. Falling down on 17, we were playing with Roger. And I remember that, you know. And Fax, when he made a big putt, he would fall down a lot. You know, he would go to his knees, you know. And so you wanted him falling down. And I remember that. And it gave him a 2-stroke lead playing the last one. It was a par 5. That was a big deal. But the highlight of them all was Davis winning 2003 TPC on a blustery day, shooting 64, winning by 6, starting the day down by 2. I mean – it was unbelievable to watch him, how well he played, and just trying to stay out of the way because he was in the, you know, so-called zone that I really hadn't seen before, you know, and that was a special, special day.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think a lot of people are interested in what you guys are into away from golf. Cubby, for you, you have this love of hockey, and I know you're very involved with the team in Sun Valley. Can you tell the listeners what it is you do with the team and how they've played the last several years, because I guess it's been pretty darn good.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in Duluth, Minnesota, so You know, that's where the hockey background comes from, because when I grew up in Duluth, the youth hockey program was probably one of the best in the country and produced a lot of great players, and I wasn't one of them. they did, you know, they went on to play in the NHL and everything, and that's where I have my passion for the game. So when I moved here and played here for 12 years and then started coaching and then came back the second time around to coach him now, the game's got so much better. The players, the caliber of the players now with the Suns, the competition. And, yeah, they've just won 3 league championships in a row. So I'm doing a job share with Billy Haas and Tommy Lambs, the other caddy. And it allows me to stay home and coach almost all winter. And, you know, that's been great because that's my passion. You know, the two things, I've been lucky, golf and hockey. I've been involved in them. Those are my two favorite things. It always have been since I was 6 or 7 years old. You know, mm-hmm. Very fortunate.
And Tony, how about you? What do you like away from golf?
Well, now I'm going up a wall, to be honest with you, because I love sports. I love to watch sports on TV. I love to follow horse racing, which they still have going right now. I go in and out of hobbies, and they don't seem to last very long. I used to love to play golf, but since I hit an 8-iron about 135 yards now, it's not so fun anymore. So I don't play a lot. I tried flying. I flew a little Cessna 172 a little bit, you know, had maybe 30 hours under my belt on that. That was fun for a while, but it's so hard to stay current on that. But all through, you know, the early days, or for the last 20 years, I'd say, raising my family when I'd come home was a main thing. That was my main priority. My kids, I have 2 daughters and wife, and we have a nice home here that, you know, that we like to upkeep, and I like to do a lot of stuff in the yard. You know, just, I do that kind of thing to stay busy now, but it was mostly family oriented, anything that I did when I came home, because we are away so much that when you come home, you need to get involved. You know, you miss so many of your children's soccer games, plays, dances, that when you come home, you need to dedicate your time to them. So that's where most of my time went for a little over 20 years.
Okay. And Cub, you talked about the bag share right now with Bill Haas. Can you just explain to the listeners how something like that works?
Yeah, we're not alone in doing this on tour. There's probably 2 or 3 players that do that now. They've been doing it for a few years. It's just that there's 2 caddies working for 1 player, and we kind of figure out the schedule and who's going to work, and we just, you know, show up. I'm not going to get into the financial end of it. It's just that, you know, I've been out there a long time. I'm getting up there, you know, and I wanted to slow down kind of, and I wanted to stay home and coach the Suns, you know, so, and Tommy was up for it too, because he's family to the Haases. He caddied for Jay forever, 35 years or so, you know. Tommy started caddying when he was 17 for Bob Golby, you know. So, yeah, it's been great for the last 3 years. It's, you know, I don't know if Billy would say it's been great, but Tommy and I have enjoyed it. So, you know, that's how it works, that caddy job share.
Now, you know, having caddied for Fax and Davis, you're around Jay Haas quite a bit. He's a good buddy of theirs. Is it pretty wild for you to see what Bill's been able to achieve on the PGA Tour? I mean, you
watch. Because I've known Bill since he was a kid, like Tommy does too, because they were always around. I mean, like Tommy does, and obviously Tony does. All the caddies remember Billy and Jay growing up, you know. So to see him actually, the genetic thing where the 2 generations of golfer and the success that he's had, like his dad, you know, his dad's very much involved in his game, great guy, you know, just like Billy. Billy's really close with Tony's player, you know. So, yeah, it's great to see him, you know. Mm-hmm. Great to see him. He's, you know, he struggled the last couple of years, but he's so talented, so good. He's going to break through it, you know. I've seen a lot of players have slumps that break through it, and he's going to break through it.
Mm-hmm. Tony, starting with you, we've kind of I guess, heard some rumors lately about the Ryder Cup and how it could potentially be played this year without fans. As two guys here who have caddied in the event, could you foresee the tournament being played without fans? I mean, I think the atmosphere there is unlike any other.
Absolutely not. I don't think there's any way they could, that the atmosphere or the competition would be anywhere near what it is when you have the fans out there. The fans really make the Ryder Cup. I know that the players are doing all the great stuff, but it's the atmosphere of the moment that really makes a Ryder Cup. And without the fans, I just don't see it happening. I really can't.
Cubby, you same boat, or do you feel different?
Well, I definitely am. I mean, because the chanting and the songs and the patriotism and everything like that and the motivation that the players get from the fans, you know, and you're playing for your country and you're playing for the different countries are represented, but no matter where you're playing, they're there, you know. It's going to be really difficult, but it's the landscape of sports right now, and it's going to be that way in hockey, and it's going to be that way in basketball if they all come back and everything. So I can't imagine it, but I think it may happen, but that's going to be very difficult because golf is a very – when it's quiet, it's eerie out there, you know, and when there's no people there, it's very eerie. So I don't – that's a whole different atmosphere that's based on that cheering and for your country. You know, that's going to be tough. It's going to be tough to watch.
Mm-hmm. One more Ryder Cup question for you, Cub. You were there in 2004 at Oakland Hills, where we had the Tiger-Phil pairing from Captain Hal Sutton. I'm just curious, you know, that was one of those deals I feel like where it was the pairing that everybody wanted to see but never thought we'd be able to see, and wanted to see it for so many reasons. How was it going to work out? You know, what was it going to be like? What was it like behind the scenes as a caddy when you saw that pairing come out? What was going through your head?
Well, first of all, Hal was so good to us guys. He was so good to the caddies. You know, he involved us in ask our opinions and everything like that. It was just a big gamble, and it was either going to work or not. If they played good together, Hal's a genius. If they didn't gel, and they didn't from the get-go, then Hal made a big mistake. And he gets thrown under the bus, and that's what happened. I personally didn't question the decision. I mean, at that point in time, you had the two best American players leading off, paired together. It definitely backfired, and he took a gamble, and I don't blame him for it. I don't hold him against that. I don't judge that. Walk in his shoes, you know. He's got the two best players. He's going to throw them out there. They're supposed to lead us, okay? It didn't work out that way. Mm-hmm. It's not anyone's fault. It's golf, you know. I don't blame him. You know, he had the big black hat on that we all bought him right away. You know, that was supposed to stay on his ranch. You know? And he got heat on that, too. And I gave Judd a lot. Judd's the one that picked it out. You know, way to go, Judd. I'd rather focus on the big black hat that the caddies gave him. That was the big mistake. The caddies gave him a black hat. Okay. It wasn't Phil and Tiger. I hope the media finally gets that straight. You know, I'm putting it out there. That was a mistake. That's what everybody should be talking about. Next.
Tony, do you have any cool stories you could share from a team room or from any of those events? Something fun that happened or unique?
Oh, there was so many fun things that happened. I'd rather share, seeing as we have Cubby on here as well, I'd rather share a little story about Cubby and myself. As we know, you know, we've been through so much together. We're very close and upfront with each other. Well, I'd worked for Adam Scott for some years and got fired. And feeling pretty bad, you know, he was one of the top three players in the world at the time. But I was mad and you know, hurt and all those things. So it took, to Cubby's defense, he waited till I got home to give me a call. Fluff called me 30 minutes after I left Jacksonville. Cubby waited for me to get home at least.
I waited 3 months.
I don't think it was 3 months, but anyway. I get the phone call from Cub, you know, it's a sad thing first, you know, hey, Tony, so sorry about, you know, hey, buddy, hang in there, you know, all this, you know, stuff, you know. Thanks, Cub, I appreciate it, man, that's nice of you. He says, then he hits me with the zinger. Is there any way that maybe you could give me Adam's phone number? I got a job, and would that be okay if I called him? I don't want to hurt our friendship or anything, but would that be okay? So I said, yeah. I said, I don't have it. I'll give you a call back with it. But nobody I'd like more to have it than you, really, Tubby. You and I, because I see it all happening. It's all coming together right here. My mind's just working. So I said, let me call you back. Let me look it up and call you back with it. So in the meantime, I call another friend of mine, Joe Damiano, very close friend. I said, hey, Joe, we got one on the line here. I said, Cubby's called me up looking for Adam's phone number. Now, I'm going to give him your phone number. I'm going to tell him it's Adam's American number up in New Jersey. I'm going to give him your number, and I need you to play along with this. You know, Cubby's going to ask you for the job. So I give Cubby the phone number. I give Cubby Joe's phone number. And now Cubby's got to work. Cubby's got to think what he's going to say, how he's going to approach this. And I might let Cubby actually finish this story because he tells it very well.
Oh, God. So I pick it up from there, you know, and I'm nervous calling Tony too, but one thing he forgot to mention is when I ask him for the number, he goes, yeah, sure. You know, you want me to leave some towels in the bag for you too? Anything else you want in there? You know, some pencils or change or anything like that? You know, and I really did wait 3 months, almost four. And I remember Nancy, my gal, was pressuring me to take a bike ride, you know, and I was trying to find a job, you know, and she's going, let's go take the bike ride. So, you know, Tony, he calls me back right when we're going out the door, and he goes, hey, you know, Cobb, there's nobody I'd rather have to have this job than you, so I'm going to give you Adam's American number. So I take it, and I said, let me dial this real fast before the bike ride. He's not going to answer. He's at the U.S. Open. He's probably on the course, right? So I dial the number, and I'm not prepared at all. And all of a sudden, after two rings, it picks up, and I hear, hey, good day, mate. And I don't even think it's an Australian accent with a New Jersey accent undertone. You know, I'm so shocked. And I'm kind of like, I'm gacking really bad. And I'm going, hey, Adam, this is Cubby. I really want to work for you. I think we do really well together. I got to go take a bike ride. He got to go, well, I'm at the U.S. Open, mate. Let me think about this a little while. I got Stevie here. I don't know what he's going to do, but okay. Bye, Adam. Click. Right? You hang up the phone. I'm buying this hook, line, and sinker. I'm on this bike ride for 45 minutes, and I am dog cussing myself the way I handled it with Nancy the whole time. She's being very patient with me, but she's kind of at it. She said, let it go, okay? Just let it go. It's not that big a deal. He's going to hire you and not going to hire you. Well, he's not going to hire me after that, you know? So I'm just so upset about it, you know? And I even think I embarrassed Tony by giving me the number, right? So I get back to the, you know, to home after the bike ride, and Tony calls me back, and he said, Cub, how'd it go? And I go, it didn't go very good, Tony. I blew that phone call. Well, he goes, it gets worse, Cub. And I go, what? How could it get worse than that? He said, well, for one thing, that was Joey Damiano you were talking to, not Adam Scott. Which for me was a huge relief, right? It was a huge, I never pursued the job after that. I recently told Adam this story maybe about 2 or 3 years ago when I was buried with him. I don't think he had heard it. Right, Tony?
Yeah.
He laughed so hard. He appreciated that story so much. He now mentions it to me a lot, you know. it was the best all time. You know, Tony called, felt bad about it. I said, don't apologize. That was one of the best pranks of all time. No question. And I fell for it the whole time. Hook, line, and sinker. Yeah.
It was a good time, though.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, guys, I think we'll end it on that. That's a tremendous story. It's all the time we have for today. Big thanks to John Covey Burke and Tony Navarro for joining the Caddy Network's Under the Strap podcast. I'm TJ Auclair. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, stay safe.